So welcome everybody. Thank you for being here. I was told I should introduce Jacob. But I'm quite sure that after the talk you will don't need any introduction to him anymore. So we are all going to witness a wonderful talk, I'm quite sure about that. And an important talk. So today is the 17th of May. I have to read this, I'm sorry about this, International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, Interphobia, Transphobia, Asexual Phobia. You all know that. It's been this day because in 1990, the WHO made this massive progress that it acknowledged that homosexuality is not a disease. Not that every country in the world has accepted that yet. Not that every person in the world has accepted that yet. And last year, in September 2021, our neighbors in Switzerland, they had a vote whether to accept same marriage, same-sex marriage. It passed with a little bit above 50%. But what also happened is that because of that election coming forward, the discussion about same-sex marriage got into the media, and there was an over 50% increase in hate crimes. And so the very fact that you have, that you talk about this opens the public, it opens also acceptance, but it also opens the way to hate crimes. And I think that is an important observation that we need more of these events. We need more information, we need more knowledge, and it has to be just an integral part of society, an integral part of our society, of our university. And the University of Konstanz in particular is very forthcoming. And the Office of Equal Opportunity, right, has taken over from a history about equal opportunity between males and females to create a much more inclusive concept of equal opportunity that includes the various aspects that are involved there. So I'm very glad that the Office of Equal Opportunity teamed up together with the university group UniQueer, with the Zebra Kino, and with the Zukunftskolleg to organize this event today on the 17th of May. And if you haven't been to the Zebra Kino, Zebra Cinema on May 12th, then you've missed an opportunity, but that cannot be repeated now. What we can do now is to listen to Jacob. And I'm really looking forward, and I don't want to take away too much time from you, and that's why I'm coming to an end. I'll have to tell you though who he is, right? He is a fellow in the school. Postdoctoral fellow, and he works on the history of sexuality, cultural history, gender history, and he has written a book about male cross-dressing performance in Britain between 1918 and 1970 that is upcoming in the California, University of California Press, right? And, but I mean, you do one thing and immediately you start the next one. So now he is working on Tutti Frutti, Little Richard, Sex, Gender, and Transgression in America and Europe. And from the printouts that I see here, I believe that we will see some details about this new work. Jacob, it's great to have you here and I'm looking forward to your talk. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Giovanni, for that great introduction. It was very kind, and I agree with you. We shouldn't be complacent about these issues, and hopefully you come away from this talk, maybe not so much with answers on queer issues, but perhaps the right questions, and maybe we can help turn the University of Konstanz into a hub of queer history, or at least you can go away and if you're not studying queer history, directly, you can apply a queer history lens to projects you're working on. So hopefully everyone will see something that applies to them and catches their eye. So the aims of this talk, we're going to consider and discuss concerns, methods, and approaches relating to the discipline of queer history. And I want you to get into the mindset of a queer historian rather than to just feed you party facts and information. I think there will be party facts you can impress your friends with, hopefully, or alienate friends with. I'm sort of trying to less teach you what to think and more how to think about queer history. So it'll be very rabbi-like, giving you questions rather than answers here. So the plan is I'll just do a shortish lecture to get you thinking. And then I'm going to hand out some primary sources that I've found in the archives and various archival jaunts as recently as just last month when I was in Los Angeles at the One Queer History Archive on University of Southern California campus. And then we'll get back together and discuss the sources we looked at in groups or in a large group. And again, there are no right answers. For some of these sources, I left them deliberately vague as to where they're from or when they're from, and hope maybe you can kind of feel your way around. Just imagine you stumbled across these in a folder somewhere and you have to piece everything together based on limited bits of information. And just to note, some of the sources involve discussions of assaults and invasive medical procedures, and some of them are, as we would say, quite homophobic. So if you would prefer to look at something a bit less visceral, you can feel free to let me know. So why do we even do queer history in the first place? Why is it important? Is it for political reasons, pure pursuit of knowledge, or the affirmation of ourselves, or, you know, a group of people? And what are some difficulties that might arise as we conduct research relating to queer history? What does queer even mean? And what kind of people does the term include and exclude, historically speaking? Does queer just mean people who are attracted to members of the same sex? Can straight people be queer in some ways? And again, these are some questions which we're constantly contending with and maybe don't have an immediate answer. Just as, again, I told you I'd give you party facts, so this is on the top left here, Ernest Bolton and Frederick Park. They were two men arrested in 1870 in London. They were arrested while in drag, and they were arrested for the great crime of conspiracy to commit sodomy. So not actually conducting sodomy, but conspiracy to do it. They had a spreadsheet or something, I guess. Actually, the coverage of their case is the first time the term drag appears in an English language publication, at least as far as drag meaning men wearing women's clothing, which is how the article meant it. So to answer the first question, or to at least approach it, why do we do queer history in the first place? So queer history started basically coming into its own as part of the post-Stonewall gay lib era. Obviously, there were, you know, people doing queer history before that, as early as, for instance, in the 19th century in Germany, you have queer periodicals that discuss queer literature and queer history, but as a kind of academic discipline, it really starts coming into its own in this post-Stonewall period, and it has a political or affirmative dimension. It's kind of tracing a usually gay identity from the past, like antiquity, to the present. And in this way, practitioners of queer history were sort of saying there's historical precedent for us. We should be considered normal, or at least somewhat normal and accepted. But subsequent histories have amended this methodology. You still see genealogical projects, but often there's a lot more nuance involved. So for instance, the historian Chris Waters says that the homosexual is not some essential and timeless being, but a relatively new category of selfhood in post-war Britain. And you also get some earlier theorists, such as Michel Foucault, who says the invention of the homosexual was in 1869/1870. He gets the date a little bit wrong, but Michel Foucault, by saying that, he's not saying, you know, some guy woke up and said, I'm gonna have sex with men today, and I'm gonna patent that, and I've invented homosexuality. He's saying that medical practitioners and the law sort of created this concept of the homosexual. David Halperin, in 2002, did Queer History to investigate, quote, how would our sense of what a human being is, of what desire is, of what our history is, of who we are, have to change once we concluded from our study of the Greeks that our erotic lives are modern cultural and psychic productions. So David Halperin is saying, you can't really easily trace a gay identity back to the Greeks. Our sense of sexuality, for instance, even just saying I'm gay, I'm bisexual, identifying based on your sexuality is a modern cultural phenomenon. So moving away from this fixed idea of sexual categories and subjectivities. And then you have other historians talk about the practical past versus the historical past. The practical past is useful in explaining the present, whereas the historical past is for the sake of knowledge with no obvious present or future utility. So you have queer historians saying, we're doing this for the sake of knowledge, we're not doing this to affirm our present day identities. Do we even really need the past to affirm our present day identities? Even if I just kind of, let's say I invented the idea of homosexuality today, would it be any less valid because it doesn't have a historical precedent? But is this political and affirmative message of queer history diluted by nuance? Does the discipline become too cold, and does it lose a wider mission once we start getting into the nitty-gritty nuances? Another good example, by the way, of kind of applying or an analog that you could compare applying present day sexual categories to the past is applying Western sexual categories to other cultural contexts. So for instance, can you call, I don't know, men who have sex with men regularly in Bhutan homosexual or gay, or do they have their own ideas of sexuality? Would they even identify based on that? And we all have certain parts of ourselves that don't necessarily feed into our identity formation. I have brown eyes, but if you went up to me and said, yeah, you're a brown-eyed person, I'd say, I guess so, you know. So not everyone in the past or even in the present is identifying themselves based on their sexuality. We're gonna see a little bit more of this person later, but perhaps you've heard of him, Magnus Hirschfeld, a sexologist, famous sexologist who opened the Institute for Sexual Science, and that was sort of a haven for gender nonconforming people and people who experienced sexual difference, and we'll see more of him later, so you can get excited. So as I alluded to, what are some difficulties which might arise as we conduct research relating into queer history. So one big example, as I mentioned, sex and gender systems in the past were different. And to what extent is it misguided to map our present ideas of sexuality and gender onto the past? So David Halperin, again, the prominence of hetero/homosexuality as a central organizing categories of thought, behavior, and erotic subjectivity does not exist in the past, necessarily. Just because someone participates in certain sexual acts doesn't necessarily make them a blank category of identity. An example of this phenomenon was the conflation of sexuality and gender presentation in the 19th and early 20th century sexology. So a German lawyer, Karl Heinrich Ulrichs, who you might have heard of, he sometimes is called the first person to come out. And he came out at a great place to come out. He came out at a legal conference. So he stood up, I guess like I'm doing now, and he came out, and he didn't get a great reception, unfortunately. He said he started theorizing and pathologizing sexuality and gender, and he said that the earning, which is his term for men who express same-sex desire, the earning's affection for other men was not merely predicated on their amorous and or sexual leanings, but was rooted in a deep-seated feminine persona. So he says, the earning is not a man, but a type of feminine being who is female, not only in the realm of sexual feelings, but his entire spiritual organism, his entire spiritual temperament and character is feminine. So Ulrichs was sort of talking about homosexuality, like some people might talk about trans issues today. And it sort of makes sense if you, like a lot like people in Ulrichs' time, if you consider, for instance, or if you think of being attracted to men as a woman-like quality, then to be attracted to men kind of puts you on a spectrum of gender crossing, if that makes sense. I'm not saying I believe this, but this sort of sums up this view that conflates gender presentation and sexuality. Similarly, a masculine presenting man in this period might engage in sexual relations with an effeminate man and still consider themselves normal. So you might have heard of the author Quentin Crisp, and Quentin Crisp, he was born in 1908. That gives you a sense of the time at which he was 30. He says, I was over 30 before, for the first time, I heard somebody say that he did not think of himself as masculine or feminine, but merely as a person attracted to other persons with male sexual organs. So in the 19th century through to the early to mid 20th century, it was quite, and even after that, it was quite common to predicate your identity on gender presentation rather than sexuality. So if you were masculine and you were the active sexual partner, in quotes, then you wouldn't necessarily think of yourself as sexually aberrant, right? If that makes sense. And I just thought I would show you, this is from Ralph M. Leck's Vita Sexualis about Karl Heinrich Ulrichs. And today, I was talking to Giovanni about this, today, you know, you go on TikTok and it seems like there's a new category of sexuality and gender launching every day. And people say, oh, this is a modern phenomenon, but look at what Karl Heinrich Ulrichs was doing. He had this whole complicated taxonomy, and he was adding to it all the time. People would write him and say, well, actually, I feel this way. And he'd say, okay, put another sexual category on the big board. It was like a writer's room in a sitcom or something. These aren't really in use today. I mean, you still sometimes hear the word hermaphrodite, but it's not really a PC thing to say. But yeah, you don't really hear anyone identifying as an earning unless they're very old school, I would say. So I'm going to show you a clip here illustrating further what I mean about how sexual and gender systems in the past were different. All right, so once again, going to lectures and conferences seemed to be a big way of coming out. So in this film, different from the others, it was a kind of a propaganda film released in 1919, and it was done with the aim of pushing for the repeal of paragraph 175, which criminalized homosexual acts in Germany, male homosexual acts. And you saw Magnus Hirschfeld up there. You were like, that's a handsome matinee idol over there. He should be in pictures. And guess what? He appears in this film, different from the others. And so in this scene from different from the others, the main character, who's a homosexual, he has a woman suitor, and he goes, how can I make her understand my affliction, is basically how it's framed in the film. How can I make her understand? I know, I'll take her to Magnus Hirschfeld's lecture, and that's how I'll come out to her, and that's how she's gonna understand my quandary. So here's Magnus Hirschfeld explaining his theory of sexual intermediaries, is what he often called it. And you'll see how he sort of conflates gender crossing with sexuality. So here we go. And that film, you can get it from the library after I return it. It was also remade in the 50s in West Germany as a film called Different From You and Me. And it was also loosely remade in 1961 in Britain, a film called Victim with Dirk Bogarde. And that film was made with a similar intention of pushing to abolish the law against homosexual acts in Britain at the time. There's a great scene in the 1957 remake of that where it's about both the original 1919 one and the 1957 one focus on a relationship between a music teacher and his pupil. And there's a great scene in the 1950s version, I think it's 1957, where the music teacher is using a theremin, and I think it's the only romantic theremin scene in film history, which is unfortunate. I think the theremin is a very romantic instrument, so I'm sorry if I've insulted any theremin users here. So another big issue in queer history is what the heck does queer even mean? And what kind of people does the term include and exclude historically speaking? Is queerness defined by behaviors, identity, cultural consciousness? So for instance, what I mean by cultural consciousness is, let's say you have a man who has sex with men in the past, sexual and romantic relationships with men, but doesn't have any sense of a wider community of queer people. Is that person still queer if they don't really have a sense of queer cultural consciousness and don't even maybe necessarily define themselves based on their sexuality? Is queerness defined by abnormality to the extent that normal is some state of being that individuals and groups of people should aspire to emulate? So for instance, sorry, I was reading that, like, huh? But now I know what I meant. This idea of normal in many respects, but we're talking about gender and sexuality here, the idea that there is a normality that society should aspire to is an extremely new concept historically. So does queerness, if you're talking about a past where there is no real normal that's held up as something that people should emulate, is there queerness? Who knows? That's what I'm asking you. So just some examples of questions queer historians concern themselves with. How have understandings of gender and sexual difference been produced and developed over time? What phenomena, institutions, and actors have been involved in this process historically? To what extent is queer history a history of sexual and gender-based repression? There's been a sort of criticism in recent years from within queer history saying we're too focused on, for instance, the history of oppressive laws that governed sexuality. You know, we should talk about queer people in the past who had fun and joy amidst, you know, sexual and gender repression. It wasn't all necessarily negative, or even if it was negative, they still had joy in between these, amidst this negativity. What are the intersections and assemblages between the experiences of queer people and that of other categories of identity? For instance, class, race, age, regional identity, etc. Oh, and I also just wanted to go back and say, I wrote down here, there were people who pushed back against this idea that to be homosexual meant you were inherently kind of on a spectrum of gender crossing. Notably, for instance, the German writers Heinrich Schurz and Adolf Brand, who you might have heard of, who advocated the notion of Männerbund, or a male bonding community. And interestingly, Heinrich Schurz argued that male bonding communities composed of, quote, bonds between men of unequal ages was responsible for, quote, nearly all higher social development. So that, I don't know if I agree, but, you know, again, these views weren't universal, and it's really difficult to pin down kind of the extent to which views of sexuality and gender were ubiquitous. The scientific community, for instance, might be working towards one view, but there were debates there. And then it's arguable whether these scientific views were percolating into the mainstream. So yes, it's always hard to pin down. You can't really ever say this society thought this way about homosexuality, for example. There's a constant dialogue, there's a constant debate happening all the time. So without further ado, let's be queer historians and analyze some primary sources that I'm going to hand out to you. So please consider the following questions in small groups and be prepared to discuss as a larger class afterwards. First, just describe the source. What is it? And what is the source talking about? Is the source queer, and does it depict queerness? Why? And how is queerness articulated by the source? But I'm hoping also that your discussions branch out into wherever they may go. This is a very silly book called Mr. Madam, Confessions of a Male Madam, a startlingly candid human document. It has not very much historical significance, but I think it's fun. So anyway, so I'll hand out these. Some of them have multiple pages, so just be aware of that. And I'll just sort of, if you want to sit like three to a table or two to a table, that might be helpful. So yeah, we might not even be able to cover everything because we've got half an hour left, but I hope, those sources got you thinking of queer history methods and how you might approach them. And again, I sort of left a lot of these things deliberately vague because I wanted to see how you would contend with them and what you thought. So is it cool if maybe a representative from each group could say what they were reading, and I'll put up stuff on the screen? So this was what one group was reading about. Is your friend a lesbian group? Can one of you speak up about what you thought about this article? I didn't show this to you, but here's the cover. It's from an August 1957 issue of Dare magazine, which is a tabloid. And maybe you got the sense that it was a tabloid from the sensationalized writing. This article talks about, it makes a very sharp turn, goes from, does your best friend insist on kissing you whenever she sees you? Does she constantly brush up against you, even in the most intimate places, seemingly by accident? Does she love to brush your hair, watch you undress, and buy you presents? That sounds great to me, first of all. that doesn't sound very sinister. But then it says in the very end, well, watch out, because she might kill you. And there's a very gruesome photo, which I won't show on the screen, because I think it's a bit too intense. But I thought you were a hardy enough group. And if you want to see an intense, bloody photo, they can show it to you. This group, what were you looking at? And let me pull up your thing on the... Yeah, that's interesting. So if you heard, it says like 1 in 1,000 are true homosexuals, and the rest are just, kind of flaky or downtrodden souls who were ensnared into the homosexual lifestyle, but they can be saved from this. And that's a common trope you often see in the mid-20th century as well, this idea of homosexuals recruiting particularly young people. And one thing that I really like about this article is just in case you aren't aware, in case you're not in the know, there's this glossary of homosexual terms that will come in handy. I don't know, if you're maybe taking a trip to somewhere where lots of homosexuals congregating, you can look up your glossary to see what the heck they're talking about. And this is sort of interesting. There's often a sort of constant fascination amongst straight society about things like this. In the 1930s, briefly, in the early 1930s in America, particularly New York City, there was a phenomenon called the pansy craze, where you would literally go to a club or a bar and you would just see an effeminate acting man do comedy or maybe, you know, some singing routines. And part of the kind of appeal was getting a sense of the homosexual underworld and getting a sense of these different terms that they used. And that would make straight people often feel cool that they would say things like, queen, I know, leader of a group of homosexuals, and mother, term of endearment, usually used towards older deviants. I use that one all the time. When I call my mom, she's like, do you mean mother as in the gay way or the regular way? Thank you, yeah. So this is from the early 1950s, I think 52, thank you. Oh no, July 1953 though. But I think she came to prominence in 1952. But yeah, also from Dare magazine, Christine Jorgensen, by the way, gets bigger coverage than is Ike, referring to the then president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, sick. So the president possibly dying is all the way on page 42, but Christine Jorgensen in a bathing suit gets top billing. And yeah, it's sort of interesting. Christine Jorgensen was not the first, but one of the first prominent cases of somebody to undergo gender confirmation surgery. And the tabloids were totally obsessed with her. They're still talking about Christine Jorgensen into the 1960s. And this is a particularly interesting article because I think, and you can feel free to disagree, but there's a sense of sexual fascination with her. They're doing this early 1950s Photoshop to envision what she would look like in a swimsuit as if, you know, readers would read about Christine Jorgensen. And the first thing would come to mind would be, I wonder what she looks like in a swimsuit. But it's interesting because in a way, as you were saying, Connie, and as your group was saying, there's a sense of acceptance of trans identities, even though it's done in a very weird way. There's a sense of acceptance there, despite the fetishization, and you know, they're saying this is correcting nature's mistake. So it's telling readers, you know, this is actually, it might be a little weird, but it's actually a good thing overall. It shows how medical science has become advanced. So, and I often found looking at these tabloids, interestingly, they seem to be more, if you could put it this way, pro-trans than pro-gay. They would often depict gay men in particular, but also lesbians, as a sinister force. Whereas with trans people, they often said, well, let's leave this up to medical science. These people have an affliction. Okay, this group over here, what were you looking at? Yeah, exactly. So thank you, yeah. I thought these letters were quite moving, and also I thought it might be good to have, you know, sources where you see queer people talking for themselves rather than what the media is saying. And yeah, this is from an organization called the Beaumont Society, and in their constitution, when they were founded in 1970, They said they were for heterosexual transvestites only. So these were people who saw themselves as straight men who enjoyed dressing up in women's clothing for whatever reason. And yeah, exactly right. TV feeling means transvestite feeling. And but now the Beaumont Society is actually for transgender people, especially I think they put an emphasis on, you know, bringing transgender people's family in as well. And I think they sort of did this here. They would often hold these events in hotels and stuff where the transvestites could wear the clothing they wanted to and not be judged. And they would invite these people. Often these were married men. So they would say, your wife can come if she's accepting and if she wants to. This letter above is, I think, is really cute. This is from one of the members of the Beaumont Society who, and you can correct me if you're wrong because you just read it, but she won an over 40s fashion show ball event. So that's quite cute. And talking just about this ball and how well she did at the ball. And then, this archive, by the way, is from the Papers of Susan, and it was left at the Wellcome Collection in London anonymously. Nobody there knows necessarily who Susan was outside of this archive or who dropped off the paper, so it's a little bit of a mystery. But they contacted me and let me look at it before anyone, so that was quite cool, but I still have no idea who Susan is. But yeah, these letters are quite... You actually get to think Susan is a bit of a flake, because, for instance, I'll read these two letters quickly. First one goes, Dear Miss, I'm sorry I do not know your name as it is not listed. My name is Paula, and I live in Newcastle upon Tyne. I've just joined the Beaumont Society, and Alja thought that if I wrote to you, you may be interested. I'm 37 years of age and interested in fashion and classical music and art. I hope we may be friends, Paula, B240, and that was probably Paula's membership number. Then Paula writes again on the 3rd of November, 1970. Dear Susan, I'm sorry that I did not you did not answer my last letter. Perhaps I upset you by what I wrote in it. This was not my intention, and I hope you will forgive me. Perhaps you have formed the wrong opinion of me, and I hope you will allow me to put things right. I hope you will allow me to be your friend. We both have this TV transvestite feeling, and I was only trying to be helpful. You did ask me to write about myself, and I fear I did it in the wrong way. I'm a very shy person and an only child. How are you getting on? Do you still feel that you want to be feminine, or is that not so strong now? You are the only person I know in this part of the world, and I'm sure we would be friends. Please let us try again. I would like to know you, your friend, Paula. So yeah, quite sad. And I also read another letter where this person who wrote about the over 40s ball tells Susan that she's bad at corresponding with people. So I think Susan is just a little bit flaky. But yeah, I was really moved by those letters when I read them. Poor Paula. I hope, you know, she found some community. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you got a few. So the Woman Marries Woman is from the 19th century, and the Hamilton Lodge balls are from the 1930s. So I sort of threw a wrench in there by giving you stuff from different time periods, but you handled it admirably. And yeah, just to thank you very much for that. Just to illuminate this a little bit, the Hamilton Lodge ball was a drag ball that kind of had its zenith in the 1930s. The New York Amsterdam News, by the way, is a black paper, and the ball was in Harlem, so it was a black run event. And the ball wasn't just, you know, drawing drag artists and stuff. It was almost like the Met Gala of its day. It was a really huge event. And I think it's interesting how the press covered it. They, you know, there's a sense that they're thinking, maybe we should be uncomfortable with this, but also it's just such a mainstay of not only Harlem culture, New York City culture, but the whole Northeast, basically. And it's a very widely covered event, and it's a proper kind of cultural touchstone. And yeah, I know this. This article was a little hard to read. You did an admirable job, but yeah, I just love. And pansies still cavort today, I'll have you know. So nothing ever changes. And maybe we can all cavort like they did at the Hamilton Lodge ball after the talk. We can have a little drink or something. And yeah, here are some people, some attendees of the Hamilton Lodge ball being depicted there. Yeah, it's interesting. You caught on to a lot of things there. This is a book which is a lot of fun to read. It's called Autobiography of an Androgen. It's by a person named Jenny June, which is a nom de plume or nom de guerre also, I think. They're talking about queer life in New York City in the turn of the century and their experiences cruising for sex often. And they identify as a fairy, which would have been an effeminate working class queer man back then. And most of the people they hook up with, sort of harkening back to what I was discussing during the talk, most of the people they're having sex with were men who would not identify as queer or homosexual at all. These were masculine presenting, rough trade, who just kind of saw this as a form of sexual release. Also back then, you know, men and women weren't mixing as much as they would today. So this was kind of hooking up with men on the street would be a way of one of their main forms of sexual release, I suppose. And it's interesting that you said how they talk about the medical procedures, because one interesting aspect of the book is this person, despite being a kind of lay person, they're quite educated about sexology. And they mention people like Kraft Ebing, and even I think Ulrichs as well. So you really get an interesting view because yeah, they're clearly trying to educate themselves about their condition. And they're also just a very weird person. There's no easier way to say. So this is them. They're talking about this sexual rendezvous in the third person. So Jenny June says, finally on the corner of Broom and Mulberry Streets, he, that's Jenny June, the writer, addresses a tall, muscular, splendid specimen of the adolescent, subsequently a member of the New York police force, who continues in conversation with him and walks along by his side. The little adolescent takes the arm of the big one into his own and presses as closely as possible against him. The spirits of the little one is the writer, are visibly heightened, and he appears more lively and animated and walks along with a quicker but extremely nervous step. He is soon seized with a sort of ague due to sexual excitement, which causes his whole body to shake and hardly permits him to speak. If we watched closely whenever the pair passed under a shadow, we would have seen the little one throw his arms rapturously around the neck of his big companion and kiss him passionately. They finally pass out of sight down one of the dark-covered alleys leading to the tenements in the rear. When, after an interval, the pair again emerge, the smaller is clinging tighter than ever to his big companion, as if afraid he might escape. They walk a block together, and then the big fellow tries to get rid of the little one, much against the latter's wishes. He tells the little fellow to go on his way, but adds, "Come around again, do you hear? I don't know whether I shall or shall not. I'm afraid we shall never meet again. How it pains me to part from you. What do you call yourself, and where do you hang out? I call myself Jenny. I work in the restaurant up on 3rd Avenue. What's your name? Where could I find you again? You can find me around this block anytime. Just ask for Red Mike. Well, goodbye. Lord bless you. I never expect to see you again, although I love you with all my heart and would like to live with you and be your slave." Kind of dramatic. The two start off in opposite directions. The little fellow walks rapidly, turns the first corner, sprints, turns another corner, and sprints, and repeats this maneuver several times as if bent on giving the slip to any possible follower. He finally reaches the Bowery and takes a train uptown to the Grand Street station. So you get a sense of the gendered dimensions there. And yeah, Jenny June is a very interesting character. We still don't know quite who Jenny June is, although there was an article with a theory recently. Yeah, I think this is a, thank you very much. Yeah, I think it's great because they've written this article about Cochinel, who's a French kind of nightclub performer and trans woman. And even though maybe their depiction of Cochinel isn't totally progressive, you have trans people writing in and sort of taking ownership of what might otherwise be seen as kind of a regressive narrative. And, you know, it's important when looking at sources like these magazines that the readers of these magazines aren't necessarily taking these articles at face value. They might read the stuff about, you know, the evil lesbians or whatever and think, what a bunch of rubbish, or, you know, I'm a lesbian and I'm not like that. So you see people here engage with the paper, and in some cases even saying, like, your magazine sucks, you know? So it's important to, you know, understand when you read these that the readership is often actively engaging with these stories and doesn't necessarily think the same way the magazine wants them to think. And you have, like I said, trans people here sort of claiming the narrative, and you know, it's quite interesting. Also, just an interesting glimpse at trans life, people talking about hormones. One person, maybe here on the next page, asks, oh, can you give me the number of that psychologist you mentioned? So, yeah, quite interesting there. Did I miss anyone? Yeah, you're always welcome to shoot me an email, honestly. You're writing an essay or something and you want some ideas for books to read, or, you know, you want to throw some ideas around, I'm totally here and available. And my hope is that the energy of this talk reverberates into the rest of the year. Please come to the Queer Gestreift Film Festival starting at the end of September. Yeah, so sign up for the Christopher Street, is it Christopher Street Bodensee? Or Christopher Street Bodensee email list so you can get in touch about all these queer events and learn about all these queer events. And yeah, hopefully, as I said, we can have this energy, queer energy, reverberate past, you know, Pride Month and everything. So, and I just thought to end, here is just a list of some approachable books on the subject of queer history if you're interested in checking out more. You have some stuff in the UK, some stuff about France, Herculean Barbin, and Germany as well. So yeah, thank you very, very much for coming, and I really appreciate everyone's input. Thank you.